Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks so much for tuning into the program once again as we dive into the collection of baseball cards and a fun pack open in this week's show as we were able to whittle down three selections of cards, an 82 Topps Cello pack, an 85 Donruss Rack pack, and an 85 Topps Cello pack. And I was pleasantly surprised with how this vote turned out, as it wasn't the oldest of the three that got selected by our listeners. That is often the case. Most collectors will go with the oldest of the three options, or sometimes I have four options. And that seemed to be the case when we first started the vote. People were leaning towards 82 Topps after 85 Donruss came out of the gate pretty strong. But in the final few hours of the election, we had three or four votes swing it the other way. And with 48% of the vote, 85 Donruss Rack just edges out 82 Topps Cello. They had 44% of the vote. And the 85 Topps Cello, which still strangely doesn't get much love, ended up with 8% of the vote. So we opened up the 85 Donruss Rack yesterday, found some pretty good hits there. Eric Davis, rookie card, also Dwight Gooden. Some Hall of Famers as well, Reggie Jackson, Phil Niekro, and some interesting players. I've set them aside from the rest of the stack. We'll briefly go through the career of some of those players. Got about eight or nine of them here that we'll talk about. And we'll talk a little bit about the 85 Donruss set, which over time has become one of my favorite sets. And certainly, it could be argued, is the best set from 1985. Now, I will argue that Fleer put out a better product than Donruss. However, Donruss, definitely not too shabby. And I think because of Donruss's start in 1981, which was a little bumpy, to say the least, even though they had gotten rolling by 1984 and 85 with some pretty good cards, I think the rough start kind of hindered their growth and certainly respect, because Donruss, very much like Fleer, put out some pretty good cards in the mid-80s, and I would even say in the late 80s. I'm one of those weirdos who actually likes the design of the 88 set, even though a lot of people don't like it because it's become the poster child of the junk wax era. Fleer had some good sets in the mid to late 80s. Donruss certainly did too, but it was always behind the eight ball after a rather clunky start in 1981, and it took him a few years to finally get rolling into the mid 80s. But the 85 Donruss set is a beautiful set, a very hard to find and gem mint condition set, and I've been pleasantly surprised by how many unopened packs of 85 Donruss there are still out there at pretty affordable cost. There are some very good cards in there, and we will talk about them in just a minute. First of all, just a reminder that as long as baseball season is continuing on, we will have Wax Ecstatic for you every Friday at noon Eastern, as we will post our podcast at our home base, Audio Boom. You can also listen in on iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Spotify, also Google Play, or wherever you listen to your podcast. I know there's a thousand different ways that you can listen to them, and I'm glad that you joined us here on this week. Of course, the video breaks, if we have one, we will post it on YouTube on Thursday, and just follow our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed for the links to the YouTube videos. So you can see the cards as we open them. You can also have a nice reference point to some of the players that I talk about in the ensuing or the following podcast. So video links go out Thursday at noon Eastern. The podcast comes out Friday at noon Eastern. And we put it all together and have a lot of fun doing it. Like I mentioned, Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed open 24/7. So talk whatever you wish about the industry. We certainly appreciate just keeping the hobby alive and well, and just talking about whatever's on your mind in the hobby. You can just post questions, comments, or even suggestions for the show at Wax and Gum Stains. And before we talk about 85 Donruss, I want to mention that one reason why I was able to get some of the 85 Donruss Rack packs, the 82 Topps Cello packs, that's right, packs, I did manage to pick up a few at the local card show this past weekend here in Tampa, is because of our donations. We've received several donations through our PayPal account. That's paypal.me/waxecstatic. And not only have I received some consistent donations, but also a couple of larger than usual donations. So again, if you've made a donation to the Wax Ecstatic PayPal account, thank you so much. And again, my promise to you is that this money just doesn't go into my pocket. It goes right back into the show. One, for technical purposes, to keep our account alive at Audio Boom, and also keep the archive as well, as we have well over 100 shows from the history of this program, but also to go out and buy the product. And as I mentioned, I picked up some 82 Top Cellos at a recent card show. Also, you know, just some gems from the four for a dollar bin, you know, some 87 and 88 tops. And, you know, I don't know if that'll get worked into the show here, but you just never know when those will come in handy. So always good to have a little stash of those. Also, I just received in the mail an eBay purchased a few 83 Donruss wax packs. So again, with your continued support, that's my National Public Radio experience, by the way. With your support, we will keep this programming coming your way. But I won't give you a coffee mug. Sorry, haven't quite worked the budget up yet to coffee mugs. I've thought about it. But also, if I do find a coffee mug, I won't rip you off in the NPR kind of way where you have to make a $100 donation for the $4 coffee mug. But anyways, with your continued support, that is how we are able to go dig a little deeper. Yeah, we can get some junk wax era stuff. We can get some current stuff. You know, we can go rummaging through the bargain bins and, you know, see what discounts we can get. Or, again, with your support, we can go out and find some of the stuff from the late 70s, the early 80s, and also some hidden gems. There's not too many 85 Donruss rack packs that are out there for a good price. Although, surprisingly, I've seen some on eBay a little bit, and regrettably, I didn't put in a bid for a lot of four of them a couple weeks ago. I put in a bid for a lot of two, which one of them, you know, we opened up in this program. And then the four lot set, I unfortunately just kind of lost track of time and didn't put in a bid. I could have gotten it for a hell of a deal. But, you know, c'est la vie. That's how things happen on eBay, unfortunately. But we're very glad that we're able to stock up the packs here, again, with your support. So, again, if you have already contributed, thank you, thank you, thank you. If you haven't yet, if you find it in your heart to donate, even if it's just a couple of dollars or $5 or whatever, we certainly appreciate all donations to keep the show going, to keep the cards coming in, and you know, at least we can have a very unique selection of cardboard to go looking through in this program. Now, next week, we will not be breaking into packs. We'll actually go back in time. In fact, we will get the flux capacitor charged up in our DeLorean, as we will go back to 1955. The long-promised show on the 1955 Topps set, and at that card show, not this past one I went to, one I went to 2 or 3 months ago here, I was able to pick up from a bargain bin. And again, I'm not much of a stickler for the you know, quality of the cards, as long as they're not thoroughly beaten up. And if you're offering them for a good price, I'll probably buy them. But the 55 Topps, I was able to pick up, I think, 8 or 9 cards from that set. No superstar cards, but a couple of recognizable names. So we will look back at the history of that set. It was the final battle in the war against Bowman. Bowman coming out with their classic TV set design card in 1955. Topps coming up with just an absolute work of art, which they improved upon in 1956, when they could have just rested on their laurels because they killed off Bowman. But 1955 Topps was a big step forward for Topps, not only in their ongoing battle with Bowman, but in terms of creativity. Some of the best cards from the 1950s come out of the 1955 Topps set. And that is one of the sets that you can argue is the best from that decade. I would put in a vote for 56 Topps over 55, or certainly 53 Topps. Still has a legendary status today, still inspires the living set for Topps. But 55 Topps is certainly nothing to shake a stick at. So we will look at 1955 Topps in next week's show, And then the following week, we will get back to a pack break, and we will mix in some of these vintage packs that I've been able to purchase recently. Lastly, I want to thank everybody at Cadority Cards, not only Chris Plowman as my guest on the program last week, but also Cadority Cards for everything that they have done to help expand the hobby, provide a nice gift to kids who want to learn more about baseball cards, but also kids who are in need of a pick-me-up, or kids who, maybe they don't get a lot of presents or treats that often. You can actually treat them to a monthly pack of cards for their favorite team, their favorite sport, or even non-sport. So if you didn't get a chance to listen to last week's episode, please do, and listen into what Chris Plowman has to say, the reason why they started Cadority Cards just a few months ago, where they think it's going to go over the next year or so, and how you can buy packs of cards from Cadority Cards, or how you can donate cards to Cadority Cards. And once I sort through a few more sets of mine from the 1980s, and also I've got some current cards, there will be a care package going out to Cadority Cards from yours truly, courtesy of Wax Ecstatic. So thanks again to Chris Plowman and everybody at Cadority Cards for their support of our program, but also for the great work that they are doing. All right, 85 Donruss. As I mentioned, this was a pleasant surprise from the election standpoint, in that I really thought that the 82 Topps Cello pack would be the one that was selected of the three. Not that I have anything wrong with 82 Topps, but I was really looking at this 85 Donruss pack because I don't believe I have ever purchased and opened an 85 Donruss pack of any kind. I've had an 85 Leaf pack, but Leaf, it's kind of getting the Canadian quarter out of the change machine at the Coke machine. It's still 25 cents, but technically it's not 25 cents, at least here in the States. It's worth about 20, and that is with all due respect to my dear friends north of the border. But Leaf and Donruss, it's much like OPG and Topps Baseball. They're good cards, but you're looking for the original brand name. So it was a thrill to open up this rack pack, and we found some great cards in there. As I mentioned, an Eric Davis rookie card, Dwight Gooden as well. Both of them in great shape, and I'm actually considering including them in a lot that I'm going to ship off to PSA and just see what the values are there. But also some pretty unique characters, some Hall of Famers as well. And a nice reminder of how great of a set this was for Donruss. As I mentioned, it was really their giant leap forward. They made a pretty good stride forward in 1984, a very popular set there. But in 85, everything fell into place. And the mid-80s were just a great time to collect baseball cards because all three of the main producers of baseball cards, and I'm leaving Sportsflix out, for a good reason, but the three main baseball card producers at that time were producing some great cards. And 1985 in particular was a great year, not only for Donruss, but also I think Fleer put out a great set. You could argue their best set, the gray border set that was kind of a build up from the quality stuff they were putting out in 83 and 84. They kept it going in 85. And I think 85 Topps is a good set too. I know a lot of people don't like the quirky design. I've called it the Cyndi Lauper card set of the 80s. I know a lot of people don't like the backs of the cards with the gray cardboard stock and the ectoplasm green backdrop and the pink, the reddish pink text. It's very 80s. There is no doubt that Topps in 1985 put out a product that was very representative of pop culture in 1985. Some collectors don't like it. I do. It's quirky, but it works. And of course, you've got the Mark McGwire rookie card. You've got Roger Clemens. You've got Kirby Puckett. You've got a second year Don Mattingly. Early career cards for the big stars from the early 80s, including Ricky Henderson and Cal Ripken Jr., and of course the great trio from 1983 of Boggs, Sandberg, and Gwynn. So you got a lot going on here in 1985, but I will argue that 85 Donruss certainly deserves to be in the conversation of the best of the three major card sets. I've always had a soft spot for 85 Fleer. I've really thought that is a great business-like approach. The pictures on the back, the full stats, the colors, the photography, everything came together for 85 Fleer. But every time I've taken a real close look at 85 Donruss over the last few years, I've really come to appreciate it even more. A 660 card set, that was the standard for Donruss back in the day, featuring a base card set including several checklists, and part of the 660 card set was the legendary Donruss Diamond King, as they led off the first 26 spots in the set, and then card number 27 was the Diamond King checklist. And of course, you had your rated rookies, including a few duds, including Doug Loman, who we randomly pulled in our first 85 Donruss podcast way back in episode number 14. And amazingly, in this rack pack, I pulled a Doug Loman who was branded rated rookie. And he never really lived up to those expectations. Although, as we explain in episode 14, if you kind of look at the story of Doug Loman and the 1984 season going into 85, it seemed like a pretty good risk. But, you know, much like the Topps rookie trophy, those rookie cards, or, you know, Upper Deck would, put out, top rookies or top prospect cards. It's a bit of a gamble. You're either hitting a home run with somebody who's blatantly, obviously going to be a star player, or at least a long-term regular player in the major leagues, or you just hit and miss. I call it the Hensley Mullins effect, where despite your best efforts, somehow, some way, the prospect fails to live up to expectations. And that was certainly the case with Doug Loman. But anyways, so you have Diamond Kings, you've got the rated rookies, you've got several key cards from the base set, and the biggest one, of course, is Roger Clemens. You've got the 85 base set rookie card there, and Kirby Puckett, and quite a few semi-stars that stand out. Again, early career cards, like I was talking about with the 85 top set. Of course, the only one that Donruss didn't have, and it's understandable why you wouldn't make a card for Mark McGwire. That's it. Of course, McGwire really wouldn't make a name for himself until his rookie season in 1987, but with the U.S. Olympic team in 1984, Topps took a gamble featuring the entire team, but it's the McGwire card that's been able to stand the test of time all these years later. So even though they didn't have Mark McGwire, Donruss, as I mentioned, had Puckett and also had Clemens and some of the top stars, Dwight Gooden, for example, the Eric Davis rookie card too. And Donruss did something, and Fleer did this as well, but both companies, I'm sure, completely not in any kind of collusion here, happened to do something in the baseball card hobby for the first time since 1971, and that is produce a set that did not have white borders. 1971 Topps, a legendary set, had the black borders. That's kind of what 85 Donruss is reaching back to, although I'll say the 71 Topps was a little more artistic and rather striking in its design. But 85 Donruss had the black borders, 85 Fleer had the gray borders, and 85 Topps had the white borders. And what's interesting is Donruss, starting in 85, would buck the trend of other card companies, and they did not have white border cards. Think about it. You go back, 86, you had what I call the Max Headroom design. 87 was actually very much a throwback to 85. Instead of red stripes in the background, you had this baseball pattern a little higher up in the middle portion of the card in the background with the black borders. And in fact, similar colors on the back. The 85 Donruss a little more beige than 87. 87 was a little more goldenrod. And then, you had the 88, 89, 90, 91 sets, all full color. They had borders, yes. It wasn't a picture that went all the way out to the border, but they shunned white borders. Ironically, Donruss went back to white borders in 1992 with a very nice effort, a premium effort to try to stay up with all the other competing card companies. But when collectors were begging to get rid of white borders and to try to make cards almost exclusively just the photos, much like Top Stadium Club really set the tone for in 1991, Donruss went in the other direction. And that was one of many reasons why collectors fell out of favor of Donruss. First of all, some pretty shoddy sets that were put out in 1990 and 1991, although I kind of like 91. 1990, we can all agree on, was just an absolute train wreck. And of course, like we've mentioned before with Score and with Fleer, the race to get the premium sets out there, that's what ultimately killed off Donruss, is that the Leaf Corporation wanted to make the Leaf sets and the the Leaf Studio sets, the really top shelf set. They wanted to make that the mainstream, and the core product for Donruss basically fell away, in fact, very quickly in the mid-1990s. But 1985 was a great year. You could argue it was Donruss's best set, not only of the decade, but certainly in their history, mostly for the design. Now, the downside for the design, of course, is those black borders. It's awfully tough to keep those cards in gem mint condition. In fact, when I opened the pack, I was looking at these cards, and you can see even the slightest little nick in the, you know, top edge or a corner, it sticks out like a sore thumb. You just cannot avoid it. So the 85 Donruss set, while it is a gorgeous set and it's a work of art, and Donruss overall improving the photography. We had an example, Tito Landrum's card was not a good photograph, so Donruss still struggling with it. But for the most part, this was their best effort. And even though there's a lot of pluses to it, getting these cards in gem mint condition is just a harrowing ordeal. So you have to hope, and I was very fortunate with the pack that I opened, with the exception of a few cards that had just a little bit of that wear and tear at the top, and that's just with age, that's not with mishandling, but with the wear and tear, finding these gem mint cards, very, very difficult. Now, with that said, that produces some scarcity. So, and this is one reason why I'm thinking of turning in that Dwight Gooden and Eric Davis card for grading. When you do find that card that is a 9 or a 10, it may behoove yourself to turn it in for grading, because there's not too many cards that are out there. In fact, a lot of cards, just again through time, you know, you're looking at 33 plus years now, you know, they get bumped around a little bit and they're going to take a little bit of abuse, even if it's unintentional. So you're getting a lot of cards that are coming out of the pack at a 7 or 8 as opposed to a 9 or a 10. So if you can find some gem mint cards for the 85 Donruss set and you do get a few hits, and even though we didn't get Clemens or Puckett in this pack, we got a couple of good young stars here. It is something that if you're fortunate to pull something that looks like a 9 or a 10, you may want to get it graded, because the value for an 85 Donruss card that's in a 9 or a 10 compared to Fleer and certainly to Topps with their white borders and the gray cardstock, typically, at least from what I've seen in some price guides, the 85 Donruss is going to be much higher than what you'll see with Fleer or Topps. Fleer had its own grading issues in 85 with gray borders, but the wear and tear did not stick out as much as the black borders in the 85 Donruss set. Now, you can still find 85 Donruss out there. Packs and rack packs are all at very affordable prices. Again, collating a complete set in mint condition, very hard to do. So an 85 Donruss set, you can still get it at a decent price, but depending on where you're getting it and the condition, you may see it for a few dollars more than what you would see for other sets from the mid-1980s. And of course, you've got those big rookie cards with Clemens and Puckett, so you have to factor that in to the whole equation. But like I said, just finding a few hits on eBay, you know, getting a couple packs for under $20. Now, it's not including shipping. But also, like I mentioned, that four-pack lot, had I put in a bid, I probably could have gotten all four for $20. So there are some good deals to be had out there, but just make sure you're getting them from a reputable dealer because even though you can't guarantee 100% that those cards are going to be flawless when you pull them out of the pack, if you decide to open it, chances are in your favor. They've been taken very good care of. And I just want to quickly put out with eBay, and I've mentioned this before, especially when you're going with even more vintage packs. So we're talking 1970s, early 80s here, and especially wax packs. Casello and rack packs, for the most part, you can't really tamper, at least you can't tamper with it and get away with it. Wax is a little different. That's, of course, why the industry went to more tamper-resistant packaging in the late 1980s. With the wax packs, make sure you're getting it from a reputable dealer. And when I say reputable, look at the eBay approval rating, if you will. If the person who is selling it does not have a 100% rating, think twice about it. Now, there is an exception. Let's say that there's a seller who has a 98.7% approval rating, but they've sold 27,000 items. Well, you know, in the grand scheme of things, you know, out of 27,000 items, you know, that 1.3% represents, you know, a couple hundred people over the time that their account has been active. So, you know, that may skew the number a little bit. But if you're looking at somebody who has 400, 500, 600 sales and does not have a 100% user rating, then I would strongly consider not buying from them. And it's mostly because eBay makes the user rating so easy. If you're not giving the seller 5 stars for description of the product or communication or shipping cost or stuff like that, then you're either A, really, really picky, or B, the seller really screwed something up. So, they've made it now, you know, it wasn't that long ago where if you, you know, gave somebody 4 stars out of 5, they would complain about it. So eBay tried to level the field by basically saying, either you were satisfied or you just absolutely hate it. So if you're satisfied, then you're going to be able to deliver a 100% rating to pretty much anything that comes, your way. If you're not satisfied, then that's going to drag down the score a little bit, and really to not be satisfied by eBay's standards now. Again, the seller really, really, really has to screw up. So again, just a word to the wise. I wouldn't say word from the wise, because sometimes I'm wise, other times I'm not. But word to the wise, if you're buying unopened wax in particular, if the eBay seller is somebody who doesn't have a 100% user rating, and that is, you know, for somebody who's sold only a few hundred items, really think twice about it. And of course, use common sense too. If the picture's blurry, if they took the picture of the pack from 8 feet away, if there's only one picture, you know, they're not showing the top and the sides and the back, then just kind of, you know, lean on the side of caution and go, do I really want to give $40, $50, $60 for this one pack when the user rating is 93.6 and I've got one picture and it's kind of blurry and it's clearly shot from the other end of the coffee table? If you have to think like that, then don't even bother. Just don't. And especially with a product like 85 Domrus, again, just because of time and handling, things are going to get dented a little bit or scratched a little bit, maybe scraped up a little bit. But if you find a reputable dealer, somebody with that 100% rating and somebody with a long history of not gypping customers or not sending damaged goods, then chances are, whether it's 85 Donruss or 87 Donruss or 71 Tops, those dark border cards that you're investing in, there's a better chance you're going to get a good product out of it. Now, obviously, with 45 cards in a rack pack, there's no way, and in certainly no good conscience, could I sit here and go through each and every card. In fact, we've had some of these cards before, or some of the players featured on the cards, including Mike Socia and also Eric Davis. In fact, we had Eric Davis in a recent pack, Howard Johnson, too. If you want a complete podcast on Eric Davis, episode 21, which was on 87 Donruss, the other black border card, kind of the twin sister to the 85 set. Go through our archives and find episode 21. You can get the whole story on him. But there were a few cards, I think like 8 or 9 cards here from this pack, that I found some very interesting personalities and stories. And I want to start with Dave Dravecki. And I mentioned this when I opened the pack. I can still, I mean, it's been almost 30 years, and I can still see the highlight of him pitching in Montreal in 1989 and his arm just snapping in two. Eerily similar to a player who played here in Tampa Bay 10 years later, Tony Saunders. Different reasons why his arm broke compared to Dave Dravecki. But such a promising career for Dravecki. Not that he was an absolute can't-miss prospect, but he was certainly a serviceable left-handed pitcher, represented the Padres in the 1983 All-Star Game in Chicago. And in the middle of the 1987 season, the Padres are going down in the standings, the San Francisco Giants going up, they're making a playoff push. They need to pick up a left-handed pitcher, along with a couple of other players. So Dravecki, Craig Lefferts, and Kevin Mitchell get traded from the Padres to the Giants for Mark Grant and Mark Davis, also third baseman Chris Brown. And Dravecki plays a part in the 7-game NLCS series, which the Giants ultimately lost to the Cardinals in 7 games. So he's becoming a star in San Francisco, not only for his pitching prowess, but also he's a very well-known, God-fearing Christian. So several of his teammates, including Atlee Hammaker, Jeff Brantley, Scott Geraltz, they're all known as the God Squad, a very, very, very enthusiastic Christian bunch here. So on and off the field, he's starting to get this pretty good reputation in San Francisco. And then, after the 1988 season, he has a tumor discovered in his left arm. So he undergoes surgery. He removes, or gets removed. He didn't remove it himself. That would have been quite a feat. But the doctors removed half of his deltoid muscle in his left arm and froze the humerus bone. And that was an attempt to try to stop the cancer cells from further invading his arm. So the doctors say, all right, you're on the shelf for at least a year. They didn't want him back pitching in the big leagues until the 1990 season. Well, Dravecki trying to push it here, and certainly I'm not going to lay blame on him for this, because I've seen athletes firsthand who are told this is when you should come back. But they're athletes. They're proud human beings. Their body has gotten them to where they are at that point in time. So they push it, and they push it, and they push it, and they push it, and they push it. And he's back on the mound in the minor leagues in the 1989 season, returns to the big leagues on August 10th, 1989, and has a really good return. He beats Cincinnati 4-3. 5 days later, the infamous game in Montreal, where he's pitching well, but then he starts feeling awkward, his arm's not feeling right. All of a sudden, his pitches are all over the place. In fact, he beaned Andrés Galarraga, and the next batter up was Tim Raines, and Dravecki, reaching back, and he makes that throw, snaps his arm in two. The humerus bone, which was frozen, just cuts in half, and he falls on the mound, a clean break between the shoulder and the elbow. So naturally, the season's over. And when they were examining the x-rays of his arm, they noticed that the cancer had returned to his arm. It was malignant too. So after a couple more surgeries to try to correct this, finally in 1991, they decided that it was best that they just amputate his left arm. So his career is completely done here. In terms of baseball, however, as you can imagine, a very strong Christian faith and going through this adversity, he becomes a motivational speaker and is still very highly sought after nearly 30 years later. Now, on a much more lighter note, at least in terms of humor, certainly not in body mass, I pull out this card of Cliff Johnson. I called him Big Cliffy Johnson. He's with Toronto here. This was near the end of his career. In fact, he would play with the Blue Jays for just a couple more seasons before hanging it up after 1986. The 83rd pick in the 1966 draft, the Houston Astros pick him up. And he was a Texas native, too, from San Antonio. And he makes his major league debut several years later. In fact, he's not, or it's not until he's a September call-up in 1972. He's with the Astros, starts gaining a reputation for a pretty dependable catcher here. Certainly a power hitter, and certainly of the model of, again, Dave Kingman, Gorman Thomas, the guy who could just swat the ball a mile or just strike out and provide a nice cool breeze for the first 10 rows in a stadium. Well, he gets moved from the Astros to the Yankees. He's part of the Yankee World Championship teams in 77 and 78. And he is also best remembered for getting in a fight with teammate Goose Gossage. And it was a bad enough fight. And again, there's a lot of mass in Cliff Johnson. It's a bad enough fight in the 1979 season to put Goose on the disabled list for 2 months. So the Yankees got the last laugh, however, after they lose their closer to this stupid fight. They send Cliff Johnson to the Indians. And there were not many worse destinations than Cleveland, Ohio, in 1979. And after that, he kind of bounces around. He's with the Cubs. He's with the A's. He did his first tour with the Blue Jays in 1983 and 84. A little stint in Texas and then back in Toronto in the 1985 season. And he is also the brother-in-law of another former big leaguer, outfielder Mike Easler. Now, speaking of former catchers for the Yankees, when Cliff Johnson made his exit to Cleveland, well, in comes Jerry Nairn. And I mentioned, Nairn is a guy that you remember more for his time as a manager, mostly with the Cincinnati Reds when they had this nice little revival in the mid-2000s. He's still a coach in the big leagues. He's been with the Arizona Diamondbacks for a couple seasons, spent most of his coaching career with the Texas Rangers in the mid to late 90s. And he took over in 2001 after the late Johnny Oates was fired by the Texas Rangers for a slow start. Well, here's a very interesting trivia note about Jerry Nairn. You can wow your friends with this. Go back to August 1979. Who was the starting catcher the first game the Yankees played after Thurman Munson died in a plane crash? You guessed it. Jerry Nairn. So that's your interesting little trivia story there. Jerry Nairn was the first catcher to play for the Yankees after Thurman Munson's death and during the moment of silence while the Yankees players were out in the field and just mourning the whole situation. Nairn actually stayed in the dugout to leave that catcher position on the field open in a show of respect. Another interesting thing about Jerry Nairn, he was the third base coach for the Israeli team at the 2017 World Baseball Classic. His daughter, Callie, one of seven kids that Jerry has. Five are of his own making and two are stepchildren, but Callie lives in Jerusalem along with her husband and children, so a neat little connection there in the World Baseball Classic. Now, as we shift gears to other players who turned out to be half-decent managers, we look at Buddy Bell, which thanks to a packaging error made us have two Buddy Bell cards here in this particular rack pack. Oh well. Could be a dreaded manager card, so I will gladly take the player soon-to-be manager card here in Buddy Bell twice. Of course, Buddy Bell, part of the Bell family that had a long history in Major League Baseball. Gus Bell, his father, a longtime outfielder in the big leagues, and also Buddy had two kids in the major leagues, David Bell and Mike Bell. Now, Buddy starts in Cleveland, kind of playing in anonymity with the Indians for much of the mid to late 70s. He's traded in a pretty big deal after the 1978 season for Toby Hara, and he goes to Texas and he starts to shine here. In fact, he would play in Texas for the next six seasons before, or I should say five and a half seasons, because he was traded midway through the 1985 season to Cincinnati. He does extremely well in a few seasons with the Reds and then bounces around a little bit at the end of his career with Houston and Texas. Later becomes a manager in Detroit and Denver and later Kansas City. Unfortunately, never really blessed with any good teams in all those years that he was in all three of those cities. But he had to get out of managing after the 2007 season after a cancer scare. And he just wanted some more time with his family. So that's what he did. Now, a few certainly, I wouldn't even call them semi-stars, but very interesting characters here. We'll start with Johnny LeMaster. I pointed out the All-Star patch on his jersey, the 1984 All-Star game held at Candlestick Park in San Francisco. He spent most of his career in San Francisco, but in the 85 season was traded to Cleveland and then went on to Pittsburgh later on in the season, wrapped up his career in Oakland a couple years later. But Johnny LeMaster is best known for two particular things. One, he hit an inside-the-park home run in his first at-bat. Happened September 2nd, 1975, against the rival Dodgers of all teams, and the Giants were not very good in 1975, so he got an awful lot of attention for that. Interestingly, in his long career, in his 12 years in the major leagues, he only hit 21 home runs over 3,191 at-bats. So a home run from Johnny LeMaster was very odd to begin with. And then the fact that it was an inside-the-park home run and his first at-bat made it even more special. He also, by the way, became the second player in Major League history to hit the inside-the-park home run. Now, he's also known for his sense of humor. He was not exactly a fan favorite in San Francisco, let's put it that way. So in July of 1979, he came out to the field at Candlestick Park wearing a jersey where, instead of LeMaster on the back, it said Boo, which of course the fans were certainly happy to oblige. If you're wondering, where is Johnny LeMaster today? He was running a store called Johnny LeMaster's Sports Center back in Kentucky. It's been bought and sold ever since then. And according to the latest notes I have here, he is still coaching baseball and football in Paintsville High School, or in Paintsville, Kentucky, rather, at Paul Blazer High School. Now, another interesting character, John Lowenstein, pictured here with the Baltimore Orioles, and I was making fun of his mustache, having the porn stash and the Ponch and John Chips sunglasses here. But coming from Wolf Point, Montana, now much like Buddy Bell, kind of started way under the radar in Cleveland throughout the 70s, went to Texas later, found a little fame with Baltimore in the late 70s, early 80s, and got a World Series with Baltimore in 1983. And it's funny when you talk about senses of humor, as we're discussing Johnny LeMaster and his Boo uniform. John Lowenstein, he was lamenting one day, this is back when he was in Cleveland, he was lamenting one day that he didn't have a fan club. So John Lowenstein decided to create and become the president and general manager of the John Lowenstein Apathy Club. He was also a broadcaster for the Baltimore Orioles for much of the late 1980s and early 1990s. So even though he wrapped up his career in Baltimore as a player in 1985, stayed connected with that organization for a very long time afterwards. Marvell Wynn, I was making fun of his Pirates uniform, and this is part of the few negatives of the photography in the 85 Donruss set. Because it was a dark background and the background of the card, you had the black border, the striking, glowing gold uniform of the Pittsburgh Pirates really stood out on his particular card here. Now, Wynn would play one more season in Pittsburgh and then moved on to San Diego in the late 80s, later the Cubs, and finished up his pro career in Japan with the Hanshin Tigers in 1991. Now, if the name Marvell Wynn sounds familiar, and you're not a Pirates, Padres, or Cubs fan, you may be thinking of his son. Yes, Marvell Wynn Jr. is a pro soccer player. He plays in the MLS. He's a defender for the San Jose Earthquakes, which is a pretty unique thing there. Marvell Wynn also has a very interesting, and that's Marvell Wynn Sr., by the way. He has a very interesting footnote in history as he, Tony Gwynn, and John Kruk became the first players in Major League history to open a game with three consecutive solo home runs in a 13-6 Padres win over the Giants in 1987. All right, a couple more cards here, some very interesting players here. One, the late Dan Quisenberry, who was best known for his submarine delivery, but believe it or not, Dan Quisenberry didn't start as a submarine pitcher. In fact, it was his manager, Jim Frey, in I think either 1979 or 1980, suggested that the Quizzer go with the submarine style. It was very popular and effective for Kent Tecolvay, of course, the Pittsburgh Pirates closer. And Tecolvay and the Pirates are celebrating a World Series victory. So Frey says, well, you might as well give that a shot. It's hard for a batter to pick up the ball with the submarine delivery. And sure enough, it worked out like magic for Quisenberry. He was one of the top relief pitchers in the early to mid-1980s, was the American League saves leader in 1980 and then 82 through 85, of course, winning a World Series with the Royals in 1985. And it should be noted, he was also the pitcher of record in the infamous Game 6 of the 85 World Series, that, of course, Don Denkinger blowing the safe call at first base, and Quizzer was the pitcher of record at that point in time. Now, he tragically passed away back in 1998. In fact, in January of 98, he was diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor, and he passed away just 8 or 9 months later. A real tragic ending. And a guy who, without a doubt, without him, the Kansas City Royals, I'm not so sure, are as successful as they would eventually be. So he helped them win a World Series in 1985, helped them get to the World Series in 1980, and helped them remain a consistent contender throughout the 1980s. Interestingly, after the 85 World Series, he was one of the rare players to move on from Kansas City to St. Louis. In fact, was playing for about a year and a half with the Cardinals. He was, in fact, released by the Royals, and it was his former Kansas City manager, Whitey Herzog, who was in charge of St. Louis, who helped pick him up off waivers, and he would wrap up his career with San Francisco in 1990. And finally, El Presidente. You know, such an interesting story about Denny Martinez. You know, a lot of people remember Denny Martinez for being one of the last successful pitchers in the Montreal Expos history. Of course, yes, I know Pedro Martinez and Ugi Urbina had his moment, but Denny Martinez was without a doubt the face of the Montreal Expos pitching staff for much of the late 80s and early 90s. And of course, you remember that perfect game that he had back in 1991. Well, you have to go way back to the 1970s when his career started. He was drafted from the nation of Nicaragua in 1973. In fact, he became the first Nicaraguan-born player to play in the major leagues. So he's drafted by the Baltimore Orioles and works his way up, makes his major league debut in September of 1976. Slowly becomes a pretty popular, although not a great pitcher in the Orioles staff, but wins a World Series in 1983, is not an all-star, but certainly a candidate for the all-star game throughout this time. A good but not great pitcher, certainly serviceable, I think is the best way to describe his early years of Baltimore. But then, while he's good but not great, he's also struggling with alcoholism, and it's affecting his game. Now, he was not a guy who would just go out and get publicly drunk. He basically just drank on the road and would kind of drink in hiding. So this would affect his performance on and off the field, and Joe Altobelli, who was the manager of the Orioles in 1983, actually did not include Martinez on the postseason roster. So he, quote-unquote, won a World Series in 1983. He did get a championship ring after all. But the 1983 shunning, if you will, and a subsequent arrest for, or a citation, I should say, for intoxication, all of this just comes crashing down on him going into 1984, and his career and life suffers. Now, he decides to go into rehab, so he's getting away from the sauce, but the problem is his game is suffering drastically. And even though he had cleaned up and gotten nice and sober, he just could not pitch the exact same way. So the Orioles finally just move him to Montreal in 1986. He does okay, but after the 86 season, has a contract dispute for the Expos, eventually signs with the Expos because nobody else is going to take a chance with him, has to work his way up from the minor leagues and works his way up all the way to Montreal in June of 1986, goes 11-4 down the stretch with a 3.30 earned run average in 22 games. So believe it or not, from being unwanted and uncertain and unsteady to working his way up through the minor leagues, in fact, starting with the independent Miami Marlins, which was a Class A team at the time, he eventually works his way back to the big leagues, is on the opening day roster in 1988, and becomes an all-star pitcher from this point on. All-star for the Expos in 90, 91, 92, and 95, as I mentioned, pitched the perfect game on July 28th, 1991, and is best remembered for his time in Montreal. Now, that's not where his career ended. He played three seasons with the Cleveland Indians, was part of that American League Championship team in 1995, and then wrapped up his career with the Seattle Mariners in the 97 and 98 season. He was part of the Houston Astros pitching staff in 2013. Of course, the Astros were not very good, so he was there for only a year. He now runs the Dennis Martinez Foundation, which helps poor children around the world. He is also a member of the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame for his years with the Expos, and he's part of the Baltimore Orioles Hall of Fame. Not too shabby for a former drunk pitcher that nobody wanted to take a chance on and who had to start out back at square one. Just think about it. 1987 is when everything just hits rock bottom for him professionally. Not personally. He had cleaned up his life. But in 1987, he's back at the very beginning. He has to work his way back up. And he manages to do that and was able to pitch in the big leagues for another, 11-12 seasons afterwards, and is well remembered really for his time in Montreal than his time in Baltimore. But they certainly still appreciated everything he was able to do for the Orioles in the late 70s, helping the Orioles get to the World Series in 1979 against Pittsburgh, being part of that World Series team in 83, even though he wasn't on the postseason roster, and still doing some very good deeds for people around the world ever since his retirement. Well, that'll do it for our show this week. Some very interesting names from the pack here, the Rat Pack of 85 Donruss. And again, if you're looking for 85 Donruss, the cards are still out there. You can still get them at decent prices. You just got to look for some decent condition packs. And that's a little harder, a little tougher than it sounds. But thankfully, there are some people who kept very, very good care of their 85 unopened Donruss packs, wax packs, or rat packs. And you can still find them for decent prices and get some good cards out of them, too. Of course, the Puckett and Clemens cards are the big names. But as we proved with our break, you can still find a gem or two. In our case, it's Doc Gooden and Eric Davis. But there are some other notable names, some other star players from that era that you can pull some great cards for. Just a reminder, next week we will be taking a look at 1955 Tops, and then the week after that, we will have another pack break, so look for another poll on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains on a Monday. So not this upcoming Monday, the following Monday, that would be October 1st. We will go ahead and do that and have some fun rummaging through some vintage cards here and seeing what we can pull from these packs. Again, we could use your help in getting these packs, so any donations you can make to paypal.me/waxecstatic is greatly appreciated. And please pass on the word In case your friends who collect or who used to collect aren't listening, tell them to listen. Tell them about Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Tell them about the show being posted every Friday at noon Eastern, and a lot of the fun that we've had over the last few months reviving the Wax Ecstatic show after our extended rain delay and getting the program back on the ground. Well, that'll do it for me. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Make sure you join us next week for another edition of Wax Ecstatic.